Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. Kate, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Laura. This is Kate Hensler. I am a developmental interventionist in the First Steps program here in Kentucky.
And we are so excited about our show tonight. If you're listening live, it's Thursday, July 30th, I think.
Yes.
At 6 o'clock Eastern time, and we're continuing our series on apraxia, and I got the most timely email that I could have gotten this week with a dad who had tons of questions about his son who's been diagnosed with apraxia by the team of therapists who are working with him, and he just had, again, such intelligent questions that I thought that I would ask him to be on the show, and he has graciously agreed and is joining us tonight, and I'll just stop and let him introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his son and their history so that we all know what's going on, and then we'll get started with his questions.
Great. Hi, Laura and Kate. This is Glenn from Santa Cruz, California, and I'm the father of William, who is a twin. He has a twin sister, and they are about to turn 3 in September, so they're at 34 months. Currently, I am in therapy, occupational therapy and speech therapy for Will, but a little bit about him is I was concerned at around 18 months when I noticed that Kate was beginning to develop, that's his sister's name, my Kate, was beginning to develop, as opposed to you, Kate,
okay.
Language skills, but William really wasn't tracking at that same level. And so when I did the pediatric checkup at about a year and a half, I had mentioned it to the pediatrician, and he said that he had some concern, but maybe it would be best just to wait until he was closer to his second birthday. And then once the second birthday came, we really had made no progress with speech for William at all. And so he probably, at his second birthday, had about 2 or 3 words, and I was very concerned about his development. And so I went to our local Early Start program, and they did an evaluation of William, where they evaluate his play skills, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, receptive language, and expressive language. And he came in fairly low on most of those, probably at the 1 year or less level. And so that's when we began to do therapy with William, with an occupational therapist and a speech therapist. And we're currently doing that about 3 days a week. So he's receiving about 4 hours of formal help a week. And then, in addition, I work with him a couple of times a day to kind of work on his just his interaction skills and his, receptive language skills.
Right. Okay, so when did you guys start therapy? That was shortly after he turned 2.
Yes, yeah. So he's been in there not quite a year, maybe about 9 months.
Okay. All right, and tell us about the kinds of things that they're working on with him.
Well, one of the things, and actually I appreciated seeing this in your DVD, Teach Me to Talk. One of the things that William really didn't have is that social interaction. He would reference you and look at folks, and if you called his name, he would look, but he didn't really interact a lot at the play level.
Right.
And so through
let
the
me interrupt you really quickly. Was he, if he didn't do it in play, did he ever do it during the course of the day? Like, how did he get his wants and needs met? Did you just kind of know what he needed, or did he initiate any of those things with you at that point?
Yeah, he did, but I think a lot of it had to do that I kind of knew what he was wanting. And,
right.
You know, the difference now is, he will come and get me, and he will, take my hand and take me over to the refrigerator. Or he'll take me over to where his shoes are when he wants to go outside.
Right.
The difference being when, at the time, at the 2 year age, he really didn't do that at all. He would kind of fuss a lot, and, there were a lot of meltdowns. But, I began to interpret what those meant.
Right. Let me ask you this. Did you said that you noticed the social interaction piece when you, and really that's become more apparent to you as you've gotten the DVD Teach Me to Talk. Did your therapist mention that as a concern early on for you?
Yes, and my biggest concern was autism. Because it's as a parent, I mean, that's a very scary thing to hear.
Right.
I think that at the age of two is what they're telling me it's very difficult to diagnose autism. And it's a spectrum disorder. And so there may be certain things that are autism-like, but maybe the child doesn't have autism. I think where we are right now is they don't think it's autism, but they do think he definitely has some delays, especially around speech
right.
and some of the fine motor skills. He is a very social boy now, and he, you know, he interacts and laughs with you when you're playing, and he really has come around to wanting to interact and play, which is something that he didn't have, you know, about 6 months ago.
That is great because, you know, as I talk about a lot in the DVD and on the podcast, that is the foundational piece for every other developmental skill that you're going to learn is being able to interact with other people, to get excited, to want to engage with them. And then building on that, kids typically start to play and do social games, and then they kind of start to learn to initiate for their wants and needs. Like you said, that he's leading you, which, again, is a great gestural skill that he has. Does he have other gestures that he's using, Glenn?
He will, yeah, so that was one of my questions I had for you also is, he, you know, we have been working a lot on signing, and he is not picking up on the signing very much, especially for things like more or please or, you know, hungry. We've watched some DVDs and so forth, but he's got a few gestures that he will use, and, you know, they're kind of like waving toward himself. Kind of like give me, with his hands, and that kind of indicates that he wants you to do something. What's interesting, and one of the questions I had for you, that is that William does not point or wave, and
right.
you know that is something that I have worked with him on for probably a year, and modeling it for him, and he and his sister and I wave goodbye to people, and you know I'll try to get him to point, but he won't point or wave.
And what do his therapists say about that?
They think it's the way they explained it is they think it's connected to language expression because he really doesn't have other areas where you know he has difficulty doing any kind of physical movement. In fact, I think he's very age adjusted for his gross motor skills and probably pretty close on a lot of the fine motor skills. But they really don't know why that's not happening. And in addition, he won't do things like clap. You know, I can model clapping, and he will do hand over hand with me, and we can clap that way, but he won't do that on his own.
Right. And he's using midline skills when he's playing. You know, he's holding like a block right in front of him.
Yes. Yes. In fact, he can.
Go ahead. I'm
sorry. Yes, he can. So he can do midline activities, and he'll clasp his hands together, mm-hmm. and he can play with blocks and manipulate things and look at them. And so there's not. There doesn't seem to be any deficiency there, but it's just in the clapping, the pointing, and waving that, you know, just are non-existent.
What does he do when you take his hands, and you said he'll let you do hand over hand, and he doesn't even try to imitate after that?
Correct. He'll do hand over hand, and he'll actually he'll put his hands on the outside of my hands, and I'll clap, and he'll follow that motion. But when I take my hands away, and then I'll clap with him, He won't imitate the clap.
Wow. You know, and they think that's part of his, is that one of the reasons they think that he's apraxic or globally dyspraxic is because he's not doing some of those things on request?
Yes, I believe so. For the motor planning piece of it, yes. But, you know, that's actually one of the questions that I have for you, whether there are just certain things that are red flags to look for. Because I can do things with William, like I can do the wheelbarrow with him where I pick up his feet, and he'll do hand over hand over hand, and he has no problem kind of doing those kind of motor planning skills,
right.
Or swinging or climbing or, you know, jumping and so forth.
Right.
So it's confusing.
It is confusing, and I do agree with your therapist in that when he's not using those kinds of movements specifically for communication, but he is able to do a similar movement when he's playing, that does look like it's communicatively based, and I think motor planning is part of that stuff as well. But those things that you're talking about, clapping, pointing, waving, those are really, really early skills that typically, you know, I'm sure you'll remember this with your Kate, come in when a child is close to one or shortly after one. So it's interesting that that's something that he hasn't done yet. Is he, if he's not pointing to things in your environment, will he point to a picture on a book? You know, if you really model pointing for him, will he imitate that from you?
No, not really. He's just beginning to, you know, to do things like recognize, you know, pictures, but he won't necessarily point to that picture.
Right. And will he copy, like if you would pat the baby or pat a dog, you know, when you're looking at a picture in a book, would he copy that kind of motion, like patting?
Yeah, not the patting piece of it. He is beginning to do things like modeling stacking blocks, where I'll take a block and stack it, and he'll watch that happen, and then he'll follow that.
Okay. All right, so he's not great on imitating even in play.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And is he doing any words for you yet?
Yeah, I'd say he probably has 10 to 20 words.
Okay.
You would have to know him well, probably, to recognize a lot of them. And they tend to be the first syllable of the word. So he'll say more if I really kind of work with him and, you know, mm-hmm. withhold, for example, and you're,
right.
as you explained the DVD, and try to get him to say more, he'll say mo.
Yeah.
But not necessarily the whole word. Now he babbles a lot. He's constantly using different sounds, and that's beginning to expand with the kinds of sounds he's making and linking together.
Right.
Well, Glenn, what I want to ask you this one: if he saw something, say, up on a counter where there wasn't a chair, or you know, on top of the console where the TV is, and he wanted it, how is he going to indicate to you that he wants something that's not within his reach?
He now comes over and takes your hand. He'll come over and grab you, and he'll pull you over to what he wants, or he'll get a chair and he'll push the chair over to the counter, and he'll get up that way and get it himself.
Mr. Independent, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
So there's no reaching at that point either. Is he going to look at you, look back at the thing, reach up, as you know, even if he doesn't have an index finger to point, he's not using that index finger. Is he doing any of that where he's reaching for it and then looking at you as if to say, come on, Daddy, I need some help here, get that for me?
Or yeah, he will kind of reach for it, and then he'll come over and just get you. Uh-huh. I think he kind of knows his limitation. But he'll take your hand and put it right on, you know, right onto the thing that, you know, if it's at the counter, he'll put your hand onto the counter.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's up to you to figure out he's looking for, you know, something on the counter.
Right. And Kate had a really good question about when does he do a lot of that joint referencing where he's looking at what he wants, looking back at you, looking at what he wants, looking back at you? Is he doing that kind of thing for you?
Yeah. I think that's just beginning to come around right now, that he's just beginning to kind of do that.
How about, does he, this is kind of off topic but somehow related, does he use utensils? Does he use a fork or a spoon to feed himself?
You know, it's interesting. No, he doesn't. He can feed himself. And I introduce, you know, a spoon and a fork, and he'll hold it in his hand and he'll, you know, drop it and just pick up the food with his fingers. And, you know, his sister is sitting right next to him, same age, and she's modeling it where she's actually eating with the fork, and I'll take the fork and put it on the plate, you know, put the food on the fork and put it in his mouth. But he's not doing it.
Yeah. What about, will he use toys in that way, like a hammer and with a ball toy or any other kind of tool? Will he feed a doll with a spoon? Will he, Kate, help me think of some other toys that Glenn might have seen him do that would have that kind of tool usage?
Well,
like
our
a xylophone,
yeah,
like a stick with a xylophone.
Yeah, so a good example is we're trying to do some music therapy where we have somebody who works with kind of delayed speech children, and she comes and plays music, and we try to get him involved with the rhythm and beating on a drum, and you know he'll hold the drumstick in his hand, but he won't beat the drum with it. Another example is there are some toys that are kind of balls that you push through using a hammer. You kind of tap them with a hammer.
That's what we were talking about. We know that toy.
Yeah.
And that's in your video also.
Right.
He'll hold a hammer, but he'll push the ball down with his hand, even though you model tapping with it.
Yeah, and what does he do when you do hand over hand and kind of make him do it?
Oh, he'll do it. At first, I believe that we probably are working with some sensory issues too, where you know he would kind of pull his hand back. But now that kind of response, that automatic kind of pulling back, is kind of not as common.
Good.
He's more tolerant of you helping him do something or doing the hand over hand with him. He doesn't balk too much.
Right. And he doesn't show a lot of the other, sensory integration things that I've read about, such as he doesn't have a problem with hot or cold or clothing or, you know, walking on his toes or those kinds of things. But I think he might have had some things around his hands that might have prevented him from, you know, wanting to be touched there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We've certainly seen those kids, haven't we, Laura?
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's another reason that your therapists think that motor planning is a significant part of what's going on with him because of that delayed even tool usage, which, again, it sounds like he can feed himself. You know, he's got that movement piece. It's not a muscle tone issue. It's just how he's using his hands to manipulate toys and, again, to do something that's in imitation when it's not really coming automatic. And that, again, is just a hallmark of apraxia and even apraxia throughout his body, that motor planning problem in that I can do it when it's something I've overlearned or when it's something that, again, is pretty automatic, like self-feeding, but I can't necessarily do it in imitation of you.
So right. I kind of have a layman question here, which is, the term apraxia, and I also hear it sometimes referred to as apraxia of speech versus apraxia, and you had just mentioned throughout the body. Are there differences, or are they always linked together?
They're not always linked together, but I tell you, when it's severe, you hardly have a child who is severely verbally apraxic, meaning that the words are very slow in coming and he can't plan, sequence, or coordinate to get a word out. And then orally apraxic is, again, problems moving his mouth, such as, I can blow out a birthday candle when you put it up to my mouth, but if you tell me to blow these bubbles, I'm not going to be able to do it on command. And those kinds of kids, when problems are severe, a lot of times do have the motor planning problems throughout their body. And PTs and OTs refer to that as kind of globally dyspraxic, maybe, or globally apraxic. And again, you can have one without the other, but when it's severe, verbal apraxia or oral apraxia, usually you see it manifest itself in play and in activities of daily living, like you're talking about with the feeding, with the poor utensil usage too. And, you know, PTs and OTs sometimes don't even really call it apraxia. They use the term motor planning probably more than even pediatric speech pathologists do. But they are related. You can't have one without the other, but it sounds like he probably has lots of that going on, especially with how he uses his hands and not
right.
being able to do those early communicative gestures and even in his play.
Right.
So I would tend to agree with that. And again, let me just say for anyone listening, we are just talking about generalities here because Kate and I have not seen your little boy. And, of course, we're not even going to pretend to diagnose or make any real specific, diagnostic statements about him because we've not seen him. The purpose of this is just for us to answer your questions and help you understand what might be going on.
Right, I understand. I do have a question then about, I think one of your previous shows talked about the warning signs or kind of the signs of apraxia.
Right.
And I believe that one of the areas you talked about is that apraxic children, I'll just tell you, when he calls me dad, he says dad-D, and he pronounces the E with a hard E, and it's prolonged.
Right.
And I didn't know whether that was an indication. I think that was a difficult thing for apraxic children to do. which kind of made me think
it
maybe.
Really is. Yeah,
okay.
Sometimes it really is. And E is a more difficult vowel, and typically children with apraxia have lots of difficulty pronouncing vowel sounds, or they're really, really inconsistent with that, and sometimes they'll pick a vowel or two and say, substitute those vowel sounds for lots of different sounds that they're using in words. But there's a caveat to that. If daddy is one of his overlearned automatic words, he really might be able to get that out and sequence that, again, because that little motor pathway is pretty darn strong.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself wouldn't necessarily mean that he did not have apraxia. But I think Kate and I were talking about that. Kate, do you remember that a couple of weeks ago when a mom said that and we said, well, if he's saying mommy, you know, that's kind of a harder pattern, so apraxia may not be what you're looking at there.
Right. But I really agree with your caveat that, it, you know, I don't think that just because a child can say a long E, he, that necessarily directly speaks to, directly speaks to whether, but I certainly have seen a lot of kids that I suspected were apraxic who did have trouble with that long E sound, but not 100%. Some of them, like Laura said, because you're daddy and you're a full-time daddy, he learned that word early, and it may not mean that he's not apraxic. It just means that he really needed to know daddy, and he got it. So.
And he probably hears Kate say it, 200 or 300 times a day.
Yeah.
So it's,
probably, yeah.
So it's a word that again, probably is more automatic and overlearned. Does he use when he's let's talk about his words for a minute and kind of look at that in the context of what we typically see with kids that are apraxic. Does he have lots of variation, you know, lots of different sounds in those words? You said he's using a lot more sounds now, but tell us what his words are and kind of so we can look at that.
So daddy is probably the most recognizable word. He can say things like diaper, but what you'll hear is the die, and it's always,
yeah.
You know, if you probably didn't know that he was referring to a diaper, you wouldn't pick that up.
Right. So he's leaving off that last syllable.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And also, he's just very slow to say it. I mean, I'll repeat it and, you know, wait, and then repeat it again and wait. And then it may come out, you know, a couple seconds later, you know,
right.
Kind of after we've moved on. But it's just basic like dog. There's a dog that we have named Charlie, and he can kind of get out Charlie. But again, you have to be very, you know, skilled in knowing that that's what he's saying. He does have he gets very excited, and sounds will come out of his mouth with a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. Usually, it's around hi when he sees, you know, when he sees the dog for the first time, he'll run up and say hi. But it's kind of very non-controlled at that point. You know, you really need to pops out, but there's just a lot of excitement and enthusiasm, and it's that, you know, that voice is just coming out. He wants to say something, but it comes out in a variety of sounds. Now, he also used to reference a couple of repetitive sounds like toka 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 toka, and he would repeat that frequently. And I would try to work with him on varying that, you know, using another consonant or using another vowel to try to give him variety. But, you know, he would keep repeating that over a period of time.
Right.
And that has begun to grow now. So he's using more vowel sounds and more consonant sounds, and he's varying in the length of speech. He's varying it with different kinds of, you know, word sounds.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, there's just not a lot of distinguishable language.
Right. Well, do you want to go ahead and start asking this your list of questions and just kind of
sure.
Take those one by one? Okay.
Yeah.
That gives
yeah,
us
I'd
a
like
good
to
background,
that.
But I'm glad we kind of established that. Kate, is there any other kind of background question you want to ask before he starts asking us his questions?
No, I think a lot of these questions will kind of bring up additional things if we haven't already touched on them. So if we don't get started, we're not going to get through them, because you had a lot of good questions. So why don't you start?
Okay. Well, one of the things I just wanted to start with, and it's a little bit of out of order from what I was originally going to ask you, but it has to do with the piece of development of speech, which is the social interaction piece.
Right.
And I, you know, wanting to give my son things that I thought he was interested in, I got him a lot of these electronic toys that, you know, you press a button and it makes some noise and it, and little lights go off.
Yeah.
And
he loved
it became, he loved them. He loved them.
Yeah.
And I thought he was happy because, oh, he was over playing with that toy and he would drag it around with him and he would press the buttons over and over again.
Right.
And recently I, you know, went to do something with him and he had his toy and I needed to change his diaper and, you know, he just basically had a meltdown that I was interrupting this thing that he was doing. And it struck me like this is a lot like, you know, an adolescent or, you know, 10-year-old playing a video game. And they are just way too into it. And I decided to remove those kinds of toys from his, you know, availability. And what I noticed is he began to start using other toys that he showed no interest in at all. And I did notice a lot more of the social aspect, you know, coming through. So
you're
I don't know if that's...
smart dad.
Have you ran across the article where Laura talks about lose the bells and whistles and all the batteries? And do your therapists provide therapy at home, Glenn? I mean, do they come
They sometimes they do, but I have found that it's not very effective when they do because he can find ways to get to avoid.
He gets away.
And so we go to a therapy center.
Yeah, I only.
But they had.
Oh, sorry.
They had often said don't. They had told me, you know, they're not really big fans of those kinds of toys. But as a parent, you know, you think that they're enjoying that.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know that he's not enjoying it, but I think what you decided was probably right, that he was kind of losing himself in that activity and, you know, beyond push the button, that's about as far as it went. And just like a teenager gets lost in a video game, he was really kind of, you know, stuck there.
Zoning out.
Yes. And so we really, you know, use very few of those, and if we do, it's really pretty much on our terms. So, you know,
right.
Or it might be a short reward for having really engaged with us and tried to do what, you know, we might give a minute of it or a couple seconds of it or, like I said, do it on our terms so that we're kind of controlling how they're using it and not really allowing them to just kind of get lost in it. So, yeah, we don't love those, and we're glad you got rid of them. So.
Yeah, okay, I just wanted to bring that up because I am noticing that the social piece is beginning to develop faster than it has. So I guess my one question is, you know, what are the red flags for apraxia? Because I had never even heard about it. And as a parent, how early would you see these showing up in your child?
You know, sometimes you can see these pretty early. And, you know, I have the DVD on apraxia coming out hopefully in the next couple of weeks. And I've got a couple little girls on there that are about 18 months. And we're seeing them do lots of the red flag things, and one thing that you really, really look for that you don't see with other speech disorders is if when he tries to say a word or when you're trying to get him to do a mouth movement that you would just see some odd off-target things. And a speech pathologist would call that oral groping or scanning. Say that if you asked him to say a word like more, he might, you know, try to open his mouth all the way and come nowhere near close to an M. Or if you ask him to stick out his tongue, he might maybe open his mouth or pucker his lips and do something, again, that's so off target from what you intended for him to do. So do you see anything like that with him?
You know, I think that the speech is just so non-existent. It's difficult to tell what he's trying to do. I know that we do, you know, I'm working with him to blow air.
Right.
And I'll put a little harmonica up and, you know, we practice, you know, with water. We put water in our mouth and we, you know, squirt the water out. And he does that fine. You know, he'll mimic me doing it and he'll do it on his own. He'll do it with air. He'll blow up his cheeks with air and let it, you know, pop out. But when I put the harmonica there and try to get him to blow, he doesn't do it at all.
Right.
So,
And that does sound like a motor planning issue when I can do it in one context, but when you're asking me to do it and getting me to do it on command, I can't necessarily coordinate my mouth muscles well enough to do it then.
Right.
Do you, with his words, does he have inconsistencies there? Because that's one thing we look for, too. Like a child might use the same word to represent lots of different things. Like on the DVD, I'll ask a little girl, you know, what's this? And she says D when it's a cat. And then I'll say, what's this? And it's the car. And she says D. You know, she's trying to label. She's trying to name some things. But it comes out her default sound. And she uses that for lots and lots of different things. And she's using it purposefully. It's not like it's a little random babble. You know, she really thinks she's doing her best to say the word that I've cued her to say. So do you notice that with him, that things are, that he might use a default word really
yes.
purposefully? And I'm okay.
He uses a default, it may not even be a word that you can understand, but he uses a lot of default, you know, combinations that he'll say over and over. And so he probably thinks he's doing something, saying
yeah.
something.
Yeah, and we see that a lot in really young kids. And, but, you know, as far as the red flags of those ages, you know, really we start to see that with kids, I think, between 1 and 2, don't you, Kate? And, you know, a lot of our referrals we get right, again, in that age range, right at 2, as, again, the pediatrician has said, wait, 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 you know, like similar to your situation, a parent might have been talking about speech at the 15-month checkup, at the 18-month checkup, and then finally, by the time the second birthday rolls around, the pediatrician decides, okay, we need to go ahead and make that referral. And so, again, you're going to see those signs early on when you are prompting words and cueing words and you're kind of waiting for them to imitate, and either one, they don't imitate at all because they can't, or when they try, it's pretty off target, or again, they do those odd little mouth movements. So those would be real red flags that a parent would see. And again, we talked about the vowel sounds, that he might have just a couple of vowel sounds and then substitute lots of those in words. That would be another red flag. But I think with what you've described, I think your parents, your therapist are thinking that it's motor planning because he's having so much difficulty purposefully using his hands for gestures, and they probably are just kind of making that assumption that it has to be verbal apraxia too. Wouldn't you agree with that, Kate, or no?
I think so. It sounds like he may not be really verbal enough yet to be totally clear on, you know what I mean? He's using some
right.
words, but if you listen to the first show about apraxia, they do kind of have to have a handful or at least, you know, some number of consistent words before you can really determine, well, what is the pattern here? Is there a pattern here? But, you know, he does definitely have some of the motor planning stuff with fine motor skills, so I don't know.
Right.
That.
That's
so,
what I think. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well,
I was just
going to
ask.
Say, you go ahead.
Go
I
ahead,
will be
Glenn.
Quiet.
Get your question out.
Oh, I forgot. I forgot the question. No, I was going to ask, what is there a cause for apraxia?
You know, we don't know that yet. We don't know specifically, you know, there's not a gene, there's not, you know, sometimes with adults, if you have a stroke or a head injury, an adult can end up with motor planning problems. But as far as with children who have had no known assaults like that, there's really no known cause right now. Apraxia-kids.org has the very best comprehensive information about childhood apraxia, and on their site they say that that's something we just don't know yet.
Okay.
You know, and lots of sometimes apraxia is the only developmental issue that a child has, but sometimes it's part of a bigger problem where kids might show delays in lots of areas, and I think that that would be what's more likely going on with William, because, you know, sometimes kids are just verbally apraxic and their receptive language is okay, and it sounds like you had some early concerns about that. His social interaction wasn't as great as you would have liked for it to have been, and certainly has improved since you've implemented some things with that. It sounds like his play and his fine motor skills are a little delayed as well, probably because of the motor planning problem. So, again, apraxia can be kind of a standalone diagnosis, or it can be part of a child's bigger issue. Autism is one diagnosis where we see children have lots of motor planning difficulties. And, it, again, it carries over not only with expression and with talking, but bleeds over into other areas of development too. So that's certainly something that parents see. Kids with Down syndrome also have motor planning problems, and we also see that speech diagnosis of apraxia accompany that as well. So again, I think your question, I think that was one of your questions, could apraxia be related to autism? And the answer to that is most certainly yes. And the speech pathologist that really is talking a lot about this right now, his name is Tamara Casper, and she works a lot with children with signing who are verbally apraxic and who are also on the spectrum. And she has some great resources for parents. She has she and Nancy Kaufman, who is another speech pathologist who is just the guru of apraxia, and they've worked together with a set of flashcards that teach parents how to teach signs and word approximations. And you can Google that if you want more information about that or any other parent who might be listening. But again, my point about this is apraxia can be part of a bigger issue. It doesn't have to be a child's only problem.
Right. So with relation to the signing, I had mentioned that William doesn't really sign, and it's certainly not something that we've spent, we've spent a lot of time working on it, and I have DVDs what we watch together, and there are basic words that we, imitate, and he knows how to sign those, and specifically more, for example, which would be one that he would use frequently. He just won't do that. But recently
let me interrupt for a second. Have you tried one of those bell and whistle toys that he loves to entice him to sign more? Have you done that?
No, I haven't, and I should probably do that, yeah.
That's what I would do. I mean, and that's what I would do if I were his therapist, too. If I knew that he was crazy about that toy, and even if I hated it and didn't want it anywhere in the house, if I had worked on more for a long, long time, but I knew that that's really his kind of hot button, that's exactly what I would use. Don't you think so, Kate? Wouldn't you do that?
I think that's a great idea. A lot of times I start with food, but some kids just really aren't that motivated about food. Generally I start with fairly unhealthy junky food because typically two-year-olds love, Cheetos and M&Ms and Skittles or whatever. But if he's not that kind of kid, you really have to get the most enticing thing. And that's what I was talking about, using those toys kind of on our terms so that you can show them, let them have it for a second, and implement some of those strategies that Laura uses in her first DVD where she's really being really playful about it. So it's not, you don't want to make them mad when you get that toy and you say, oh, it's my toy, it's mine. And he comes after it and you say, oh, you want more. Keep it real playful so that he gets the idea. Daddy's being funny. Daddy's playing with me. And gee, all I have to do is put my hands up there. And I'm sure your therapists have talked to you about, we, particularly in the beginning, are not picky about whether they put their little fingertips together. A lot of kids, or at least a lot of kids I've seen, will take an index finger and stick it in the palm of their hand for more. Some kids will clap. Some kids fist their hands and bring those together. Anything where he is taking his hands and getting them to midline in some rough approximation of more, by all means, take that as more and reward them. Give him that toy. Let him have it for a minute or two.
And I think 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because you want to get that sign again as quickly as you can, because with kids with motor planning problems, repetition is what really makes that motor pathway in his little brain more solid. So the more you can get him to do it over and over and over, the more consistent that's going to be. That's one idea that I would try for that. And let me ask you, is he an eater? Is he a snacker?
He's not big on the snack, no.
I think the toy
would be much more enticing.
I would do that. And then the other thing I would do is have Kate right there with him and really get her to do it and say, Kate, tell Daddy more, tell me more, and have her sign it and say it. And then as soon as she does it, really give her the toy, but take it back pretty fast and then give him an opportunity to do it.
Okay.
That's how I would work on signs.
And that
go ahead, Kate.
I was thinking when you were talking about how he does that, put his hands over your hands. I really, really try and discourage that. Not that it's a bad thing, but because you want him to be independent, whether it's with signing or other, play-related tasks. And kids sometimes do have that tendency to just kind of reach up and go, oh, that's hard, you do it, Daddy. And he just kind of goes along for the ride. And years ago, I used to let that go a lot longer and a lot more than I do now. Now I really kind of say, you do it. And what I suggest is you get him as close to it as you can, or even get his hands together. Keep modeling it, and then back off of how much help you're giving him. But don't let him get stuck in that trap of just reaching up and you doing it
I think you really need to, you know, today or tomorrow when you really start targeting this again or continue to target, just really, really discourage that. I'm going to be dependent on you, and I'll just reach up and you do it for me, Daddy. You really need to push him into, Will's a big boy. He's going to do it. I mean, I've had so many kids who, when you really start pushing in a playful, fun, loving way, by gum, they do get it.
Right. The other thing I would do is make lots of mistakes. If he's trying to put your hand on something on the counter, I would totally put it on something else. And you might have already tried some of these, but sometimes with kids, you let a strategy go for a couple of months and then you try it again, and it really works so much better than the first time that you did it. So just because something didn't necessarily work 6 months ago doesn't mean that you're not going to want to give that a whirl again. Let's move on. You said that he recently has started liking pictures and wanting to use some pictures to communicate, and I think that's a fabulous idea. Kate and I did a show on the picture exchange communication system back like in December or something, and there's an article on the website at teachmeatotalk.com about that as well. Are your therapists helping you implement some pictures at home and in therapy?
Yes, and so they'll give him an option of two different toys, and they'll show him pictures of the toys. He'll pick that one picture, and then he'll look for it in the room, and he'll go get it. So he definitely is linking that picture with, you know, something that he wants, and, you know, he finds it. So the picture and the object are linked together for him.
That's great. Have they started where he's trading the picture, where he has to pick the picture up and then give it to the therapist or give it to you to get the toy? Have you used it in that context yet?
No, we have not. We've kind of just used it where those items are in the room, and we give them an option of, you know, do you want bubbles or do you want to play blocks?
Right.
And they'll show him pictures of those, and he'll pick up one, and then he'll go over and get it. You know,
yeah. You know, and I would build on that, and I think that's a great start, but I would take a look at the guidelines for picture exchange communication system, and you can either, again, Google that and read it directly from that site, or there's an article about that on my website about how to use that and how to really do that sequentially so that that becomes really communicative for him. And there's lots of good research that says, and Kate and I both have seen this with children that we've worked with over the years, that once they get that whole piece of, oh my goodness, I've got to really do something to get something, and again, it's going to be you're expanding his options beyond just using your hand to do it. You know, he has to scan the different pictures, pick up the one he wants, and then place it in your hand. Again, that's more of an initiating act than even taking your hand to do it, because it's something that he's done totally on his own. So I would really encourage you to take that next step and follow that program like it's supposed to be implemented.
Yeah, it sounds like he gets the basic premise that that picture represents that toy, but it is important, I agree, Laura, to build in. He's got to initiate the communication. He's got to give it to you, and then he gets the toy. So,
all right, okay.
Instead of him still being so in control, because I think, you know, and the other thing that I don't really do with kids, and again, I'm not knocking your therapist because I'm sure they have very sound clinical reasons that they're doing that, but I really like it where I'm kind of holding all the goodies, and he has to really give it to me, because that, again, builds in that communication piece where he's looking at me, and he's got to put that picture in my hand and not just kind of grab it from somebody else's hand. I don't know how you used it. Was he just picking it from someone's hand, or was he picking it up and giving it to someone, the picture?
No, he was walking over to the actual object, so he would be offered two pictures. He'd pick up the picture of the block, go to the blocks.
Yeah, and I think that's great to work on comprehension, but it's, and, you know, object association, and do you get what I'm talking about? Do you want to play with me? That's great, but I think it sounds like he's ready for that next level where you really want to step it up and make it more communicative, and you want him to really pick up that picture and give it to you. And again, there's an article on the website, and I've got your email, so I'm just going to send you that link so that you can look at that. And even if you're not using it that way in therapy, that's the only way that I would use pictures at home, because again, I think it's the very best way for kids to learn. I've got to initiate this, and I have to do something to get something, and my dad's not really going to give it to me until I tell him exactly what it is by using this picture. So I would make that change at home as well. You agree with that, don't you, Kate?
Absolutely. I think that's very important. And I've had a lot of, you know, quite a few kids who signs, I love signs. I think they're really more natural than pictures. However, some kids are just not naturally good signers, and it is tough to get them going with it, and you try.
Well, and they've worked on this for 9 months.
Right, right. But
yeah.
My point is, I've had quite a few kids that when you really use those pictures that way, you do see that light go off, and they seem to get that whole, oh, I have to either give you something, sign something, say something. I have to do something concrete in order to get what I want. And once they get that, these words, these pictures, these signs all have meaning. And if I share them with you, I get what I want. Pictures can be a really good way to get that point across. And a lot of times when they get it with the pictures, then they, lo and behold, get the signs.
They really do. And we've seen that happen a lot. And if I am not having good luck with signs, I back up and use pictures, but I always start with signs. So
okay.
I think we like them better.
But for some kids.
Well, and again, the reason we like signs so much is because kids usually need the help motor planning, and it sounds like he is still going to need that help, but if he can't do that quite yet, and if he's pretty visual, meaning, and we know that he is because that's probably the reason he likes those toys so much that light up, and, you know, with the push the button and then I get that instantaneous reward with the light going
right.
off. You know, it probably sounds like that's a learning strength for him, so that's why pictures would be so successful right now. But I wouldn't totally give him the sign either.
For a lot of kids, it's a difficult step to get them to associate this picture represents this particular toy, but it sounds like he has that piece.
Right.
It's just that I have to give it to somebody directly in order to get. The other thing, that builds so much more independence. So he could be in the front room or the family room and get a picture of whatever it is he wanted and bring it to you, as opposed to he gets his picture and he's looking around. You know, he's left out the social connection there if you're not part of the
right.
equation.
The initiation. And it sounds like he's got the ability to initiate with you for a quest because he wants to come and get you with his hands. But I wonder, is he really realizing, okay, this is Daddy, and I've got to, again, make that social connection where I'm looking at what I want, looking at Daddy, looking at what I want, looking at Daddy, or is he thinking, I'm just going to use these hands because these hands work and can kind of, you know, and again, sometimes that social piece might not really be there. And, you know, we're just talking, again, in generalities because we haven't had the pleasure of meeting you guys and seeing William, so I don't know that. I'm just kind of guessing that that has become kind of an easy option for him. Like Kate was
yes, I think
about.
You're right. I think you're right on that. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I would try to sabotage that a little bit too. Again, by when he's telling you what to get, I would make all kinds of mistakes with that. If he's putting your hand kind of close to the milk on the counter, I would reach over and grab a dish towel and say this, so that he's forced to, you know, extend that communicative effort. And again, not to the point where he's laying down on the floor kicking and screaming. And you're going to make it playful and make it fun, but so that you're making him work just a little bit harder to get you to understand what he wants. And that's the part that makes it communicative and makes it interactive.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, it does. But along those lines on trying to build that social interaction piece, do you recommend for somebody like William that, I was thinking about even a preschool where he would be around peers, but then I'm concerned that he's not where they are, and it may be frustrating
right.
for him.
Well, he's got the best little peer model in that you have somebody with him 24/7 to do those things with his twin sister.
Yeah.
You know, and I personally, unless it's a language-based preschool, I'm not sure that, and with really specialized teachers or therapists really running that program, he could get lost in the shuffle. And kids like him really do, because, again, they're not the ones really telling somebody what they want and what they need. So unless it's a pretty specialized program, because of the significance of his language delay, I probably wouldn't count on that yet. Are they helping you transition to a preschool program that they think would be helpful for him?
Yes, and in California, I think the school district takes over after the age of 3, and so they will present me with some options of what they think would be good for William, but they haven't yet done that. But that does happen here.
Yeah, and I would certainly follow through with that, because any program that they would recommend certainly have probably worked with, you know, they have experience with children with language delays and with motor planning problems. So, again, that's going to be more beneficial to him than if you just did even a private program where they didn't have a component where they worked with children who had experienced delays before. So to get the most bang for your buck, even if you're doing it, you know, through the public schools, you're going to want that time to be maximized for him and want to do it with folks who've worked with kids like him before, or else,
okay,
you know, that's just not going to be the most optimal use of his time.
Right. And if I was going to do that as a parent on my own, and you said a language-based preschool, is that
right,
something that's pretty easy for me to investigate? I can check to see if a school is language-based or they specialize
that's
in
the
language?
Question. Yeah, and you're going to want to see if they have a speech pathologist on staff and if they are doing things like signing or using pictures to supplement a child's communicative efforts in the classroom. So you're going to really talk about that with them, and your therapist should really be helping you with that too. If you say, gosh, we don't really want to do the public school option, what are some other preschools where we know that he can do, you know, so that language is a big deal and so that he's going to have some supports in place and, again, move him further along. So that's something that your therapist should be pretty involved with as well. And tick-tock, they're turning 3 in September. So that's something I would really get on now, because lots of times the great preschools are full. And so you're going to want to do that pretty quickly.
All right.
And just to make it clear, best case scenario, it's a program that already does that. They already have, you know, not...
Right.
Because good programs may say they're open to it, but if you have teachers who have never really done it, really haven't experienced it, I think you'll get, again, more bang for your buck if you go to a program that does that, because they have whatever number of kids in the program who have language delays, and that's part of their regular, everyday thing. You know, it's no big deal for them to implement it for Will, because they're doing it for 3 other kids, and they are very familiar with how it works and how to work that into the program. And I would think Santa Cruz is big enough that you would probably have something like that available, so...
Yeah,
some pretty good
right.
options. And, you know, and I, you know, we're not in California, so we certainly don't know how solid those public school preschool programs are, but so many times that's where you're going to find those systems that are well established, because he would not have been the first speech language delay disordered kid that they've ever seen. And so they've already worked that out. And again, like Kate said, it's part of their system. They're not coming up with new ideas just for him. They've seen it. They've done it. This is what they do every day and what they're good at. So don't necessarily discount that program as well. I would give that a look. And I encourage all my parents here to do that too. Even parents who were in, you know, certainly were thinking they were going to do private education anyway, you know, and are looking at some of those programs. Sometimes the public schools offer those systems that, like Kate said, they've never, a private school may not have had to do that before. So again, that you're just going to want to look at all your options and think about what's the best match for him. And again, the best way to move it along.
Great.
Let's see. I think the only other question that we haven't really talked about, we haven't talked about the prognosis piece for a kid who's still struggling at turning 3 with language, you know, and that is so individualized. I have a hard time even with kids that I'm first meeting, you know, if I were just evaluating William today and just meeting you today, being, or even kids that I've worked with for a while, really knowing when they're going to catch up or when they're going to be quote unquote not delayed anymore, you know, so that would be hard for Kate and me to really talk about because we haven't met him.
Yeah, I think not knowing, and I sound, you know, you've seen this over a period of years, but not knowing as a parent, you know, is it even a hope that he's going to catch up?
There's always hope, because, you know, and children's brains really are able to compensate for things that they can't do at 2 or can't do at 3. Sometimes I'll see a kid that I think, oh my goodness, I can't believe this kid. You know, he was still, like William, minimally verbal at turning 3, and then I see him when he's in kindergarten or first grade, and he looks pretty good to me. He's talking. He's communicating. But there are those kids that really continue to struggle at 3, continue to struggle at 4, continue to struggle at 5. Another thing that I would say is that children like this have a higher propensity toward academic problems as well, because if you're having difficulty with sounds and getting all the sounds in the right places, it makes you more at risk for reading problems and those kinds of things later. And because he's having so much difficulty right now with fine motor things, I would think writing, it would be a challenge for him too, unless that really, really gets moving in the right direction. But again, we haven't seen him, but just based on what you've said, you know, he's going to still need a pretty intense therapy program, and you guys have been so lucky to be able to do 3 times a week. I would really look to continue that level of programming to make sure that you're doing everything that you can to give him the best possible start by the time he's in kindergarten.
Right.
Would you agree with that, Kate?
Absolutely. I was reading through your questions, Glenn. You did ask something about apraxia and diet and gluten-free. Talked about gluten-free diet with kids who are on the spectrum, and then asked about apraxia. Laura, do you want to say anything about that, or shall I?
Go ahead and take a stab at it, and then I'll tell
okay.
you what I think.
Yeah, I don't know that specifically diet. There is some literature that suggests some kids who have problems with motor planning or apraxia may benefit from some kind of omega-3 supplement. I don't know specifics. I usually refer to the late talking child and look what they say for apraxic kids. Do you know what it is exactly, Laura?
You know, I don't even really give parents specific recommendations about that. And here's the reason why, because I'm not a doctor and I'm not a nutritionist and I'm not a pharmacist. So I really try not to make those really specific recommendations like that. But the book that Kate's referring to is called The Late Talker, and it's by Marilyn, I think her last name is
Agin.
Yeah, A-G-I-N. Have your therapist talked to you about that book, Glenn? Do you know that?
No, they have not. No, I've not heard of it.
Okay, it's called The Late Talker, and it really talks about children that are apraxic and late talkers, and again, it outlines that whole fish oil recommendation. There's an article or two on my website about it as well, and that site that article has links to other places so that you can get that information. So that's something that I would probably, if your therapists are, you know, again, pretty solid with their diagnosis of apraxia, it doesn't hurt to look at that. The gluten-free.
I'd be riskier than that, Laura. I'd say this. I've never had a parent who consulted their pediatrician that the pediatrician wasn't willing to say, yeah, I'll give that a shot. And I've never really had a child who responded negatively to, whether it be flaxseed oil or some kind of fish oil. Or to me, it's kind of like an easy thing to try that may help and almost assuredly won't hurt. I would definitely clear it with your pediatrician, but if you were my child, I would certainly give it a shot. You know, I don't think it's going to hurt anything, and it may help a little bit. So I'd say some of the diet stuff I think does help some of the kids on the spectrum, but that's very child-specific, and I suspect that using the fish oil supplements is child-specific, but that's a lot easier than the diet.
Right. Have your therapists recommended the diet before? Have they talked to you about that specifically for William or no?
No, they haven't. And that's something that I had taken a look at and had seen a lot of comments about that specifically with autism,
right?
Which is, you know, getting all the attention right now. And, you know, there are claims that it helps to reduce the symptoms of autism. And
right.
So that I was just thinking maybe that's with apraxia also.
Not necessarily with apraxia. The things that we see recommended for that, again, are the fish oil supplements.
Right.
And you can again, investigate. Some parents have kids that will swallow those pills. Most of the time I think they do the whole pinhole method and squeeze it into a drink, maybe chocolate milk or something else that he really, really likes because it doesn't taste well. You know, it has a horrible taste. It doesn't taste that good to kids. And so you're going to want to kind of do your research on that and decide exactly what you think would work for him for that. But fish
Great.
Oil is the way to go if apraxia seems to be what everyone is coming to a general consensus.
Great, I'll check that out.
Yeah, I think it's worth a shot myself. Like I said, I don't think there's much of a downside at all, and it's pretty inexpensive, and as long as you can get it in them,
you know, you're working hard on every other front, might as well see if that isn't part of the puzzle. And if it is, great, that's an easy fix. So,
great, I'll try it.
I'd give it a shot, but
yeah.
Was there anything else, Laura?
Well, we're down to our last few minutes. Glenn, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you really wanted us to address?
No, this has been great. And I think, you know, for parents like me who are just not familiar with what this is and, you know, what to expect and what we can do, you know, your website's been incredible. And just being able to ask you the questions has been very helpful for me. So I appreciate your time.
Well,
we appreciate
you so much for calling in. Yeah,
Laura,
we really
Laura
did.
Emailed me the letter, the email that you had sent, and she said, "It's just so great. It's like we made it up." And I thought perhaps she had, but then you do exist. So
I do exist. Yes.
A great dad in California who's just trying to figure it all out. But it was fun.
Yeah,
to
I'm sure there's a lot of parents out there like me. I'm sure.
There are.
I think so, because we see them every day.
Mm-hmm.
These are, you're like the parents, certainly like the parents on my caseload. And to thank you for your participation, I want to ask you that you send me your, via email, your shipping address so that I can send you the new Apraxia DVD that's coming out. And it is loaded with therapy techniques, not only, you know, kind of the diagnostic information that we've really talked about tonight and we've talked about on the podcast for the last couple of weeks, but lots and lots of real-life practical things that you and that your therapist can implement with him really to get speech and language going. So please send me your
That's
address
great.
So that I can thank
you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And that's all for this week. Join us next week, and we're going to continue our discussion about apraxia and treatment techniques that might help kids get going with speech. Thanks
Sounds
so much.
Fresh. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.